Right, thanks, Yvonne. I must say, I'm a little nervous, to be fair, as one does at these events. So here I am in New Zealand, down the bottom in the Pacific Ocean, just Elanor, New Zealand. We are a small country, just an overview, 5 million odd, and we'd be lucky. We probably have 80 meetings in New Zealand. It's like a big family, really. Unlike some of your bigger counterparts. So if you get into service, you get to know most people. So it was a great thing. How did it all happen? So really, I've got a story. I don't know that it's going to last 45 minutes, but we'll just do what we do and see where it happens. So a long time ago, as we've already alluded to, I have a Dutch name. My parents immigrated to New Zealand. In the 50s or 50, somewhere around there, they went to Australia first and then came across the great immigration of Dutch. There was many waves of them to all parts of the world. And we ended up in Christchurch, which is about mid-South Island. Well, they ended up there, and that's where I was born. I've got an older brother. We just started off life, and I suppose the significant things, because all of this that I share today is with the benefit of hindsight and working the steps as such, because I didn't know it when it happened, but obviously some things happened internally or otherwise. So when I was 3-4 years of age, my mother jumped the fence for a younger man, a younger version, and of course at 3 or 4 years of age, I didn't understand any of that. I just knew that she was gone, and that's something I couldn't understand. And she appeared occasionally, and that wasn't from want of anything. I understand that today. It was just in those days. My father held us as captives, really, I suppose, my brother and I, and didn't allow her access. And that was what it was. We ended up with having a whole lot of housekeepers, single mums with one child normally. We had a two-bedroom house, so they got one room and we slept in the other with Dad. I think they went on for 3 years. Mother appeared infrequently, but as frequently as she was allowed or could. So I think that created some angst internally for me. Not that I recognised it at the time, of course. When she did go, again, one day Dad put us in the car. We had an old 27 Essex, and he went for a drive across Christchurch. And we got to this building, and there was lots of girls. And I know today it was a girls' school, but he dropped us off, and he handed us an orange each and said goodbye. And so my brother's 5, and I'm 4, you know, 4 years of age or whatever it was. And this man disappears. So mum's gone. We're dropped off on this drive, and I'm feeling a bit lost, to be fair. And I think at that time, probably Dutch was our first language because it was spoken in the home. It's only when I went to school that we learned a lot more English. And so I remember clearly being in this place, totally lost. And all these people, I mean, they were kind and everything. But I would hang around all day, wait for my brother to get back from school, and then we'd jump the fence and run down to the train station, or what we thought was a train station. The train crossed the road, just down the road from the school. And we'd stand there in the hope that it would stop and take us home or take us back to where we knew. And it never did, of course. The bells went and the trains roared past. So we had those experiences then. And then probably mum came back into our lives 8-9 years of age. I'm not sure. We started the normal changing households, you know, one during the week, school with mother, and then weekends with father. It's just the way it was, I imagine. We lived in a rural area as such. The outskirts of Christchurch at that time was rural. And we played in a forest and had a good childhood as such. But one of the things that happened somewhere at that age, 8, 9, 10 years of age, was we used to trek through the forest every weekend and pretend we were hunters and trap rabbits and that sort of stuff. And head out to the beach and get shellfish so we could go fishing, use it for bait or even eat it. And it was an isolated part of the beach. And, of course, we always used to, at that time, we ran into a group of men that were nudists. And they left us alone as such, but then they started to engage, or one particular man started to engage with us, and ended up showing us magazines, Sun magazines, which was the old magazine of the time. And in the end, my best friend of mine and I ended up masturbating. So I realised today as an adult, of course, I was groomed. We were groomed over a period of weeks doing this to get to that point. And that was the end of it as such. We never saw him again, I don't think. And at that time, it was what it was. But certainly as I got into adolescence, a stain of shame sort of blotted my memories, or blotted my ability to interact. I suppose I closed off. So growing into adolescence, I just felt uncomfortable, really. And every time that my mind turned to that one particular incident, it was full of shame, and it was a secret, and it just seemed to affect the way I lived. I probably started to attach myself to other people in the school, when they weren't always the best role models. It was just that I believe today that I wanted to have a friend. I wanted someone to like me. I just didn't feel likable, I imagine. So I used to get a wee bit in trouble, because to belong to some of these fellas, of course, you did some dumb stuff. However, we got through that process, and all of it, with the good and the bad. I mean, life continued. I was good at sports. Rugby, of course, is a favourite sport here in New Zealand. So one always aspires to be an All Black. So I did all right at school in the first 15, things like that. And ultimately, I left school 17 and a half age and joined my career, which was a police officer. So in those days, they had a cadet school. You used to go in for 18 months. You'd come out as 19-year-olds, and then you could go out and keep law and order. Now, I'm pretty sure that I always wanted to be one. So that was a dream come true, I suppose. And 18 months with another group of young men, we formed close bonds that we still carry today. And I was finally posted to Dunedin. Well, at the end of it all, I ended up in Dunedin as my posting, and started to work. And I think to a degree that outwardly, of course, I appeared quite calm and collected and in charge of oneself. But, of course, internally, the old mental torment, that lack of self-belief or whatever, was always there. And as I've heard in the rooms of Al-Anon, like the swan, I appeared regal outside and steady, but underneath the old feet were flapping just to keep up with the strain, with the river. Anyhow, life continued, and I suppose that was, like part one that got me to there. So I was cut off, inarticulate with the opposite sex. And, of course, I still desire to be loved or wanted by somebody. And then even in that time, I suppose, food became a comfort. One of those negative cycles, feeling uncomfortable, let's eat some food, or let's get fat, or now I feel horrible. So those sorts of things were happening. Plus, I was out in the real world just loving work and doing what you do, engaging that as a young man, and being part of another family, really, the police family. In New Zealand, there's only one police department. It's a national department, so the same rule from the top to the bottom. And it kept functioning at that level. Of course, did the normal things. You went out, and I was looking for a mate. And I suppose that's part two of life. I was out one night at a party, and I saw this young lady, and she seemed to be smiling at me, and I smiled at her. I didn't really know what to say. Probably I was drinking beer or a social lubricant that allowed me to communicate. Anyway, we interacted, and as it turns out, she was the mother, to become the mother of our three children. To her place, which was pleasant. I didn't have to talk or work out a way to get that part of life satisfied in that moment. And so we were hooked in together, I suppose. It was a, a tortuous relationship, I suppose. It was on, it was off. We were together, we broke up. This happened over a period of a couple of years. Ultimately, she said, well, that's it, we're finished, and was going to go off to Australia. And then sort of 6 months after we'd broken up, gave me a ring and said, oh, I'm having a farewell party, you want to come? And we got back together, and then we stayed together, and she didn't go overseas. I was, well, I mean, it's not all good, it's not all bad. It was just, that was life. We had some really good times, and we carried on. Then the police department shifted me. Historically, way back then, you have to apply to get married in our police department, and they would go and do family checks and interview all your friends and family. So it was meant to be a long process. So I put my application in on the Friday, and we got married at a registry office on the Tuesday, which, of course, didn't allow them any time. But I'm sure in a response to that, they transferred me out of Dunedin to a small town further south in Balclutha. We continued. I mean, I went to work. I was important in my own head in society, I suppose, as we are. Played sport. I did very well in sport in South Otago. And that became a major focus for me, because certainly when I was playing sport and playing it well, all those people that supported us told me I was wonderful, keeping in this illusion that I was wonderful. But, of course, I didn't want to really rush home all the time. And so I don't know that we discussed the meaning of life, the future, housing, how many children, all those things. Something happened here to the screen. Anyhow, I suppose I always, as a male, wanted to have more physical contact than was on offer, and that created a bit of a discussion in our house on many different times, and it became, it became an obsession for me, really, on reflection, just, bashing your head against a wall. And then in the end, when you're arguing about something and get obsessed about it, it doesn't really work well either. So then throughout the course of the relationship, I was probably verbally castrated, felt uncomfortable, and ultimately when you're not getting what you don't get at home, you go looking elsewhere. The trouble with that, of course, is mentally I was I couldn't handle it. I was always feeling on edge, and I had that sense of righteousness about me, but today I suppose you call it justification for my behaviours. Anyway, we continued on there, and our three daughters arrived over a five-year period. And really the focus of life was either we were going to work or we were talking through our children. And that was the only way. That's the memory. I mean, it's quite distant now, but that's the memory. That was the consistency. We could talk what our children were about to do that day or had to be done for the next week, and that was our communication. And occasionally we would plan holidays. I'm not saying that she pulled out all of them, but most of them. And I ended up taking my children away on holiday a lot by myself. And she did whatever she did. So that went on for a period. We did a geographical. We moved from Balclutha then into Alexandria, where I am again today. I've been here and left and come back again. And, of course, the old geographical. As I've learned in the rooms, our bodies move to a different environment, but our heads come with us. Not a hell of a lot changed, really, in the existence. And in saying that, life, you've been there. You know, life is normal on the outside. You still attend functions, do stuff. I belong to many groups because that made me feel important or self-important. But ultimately, We were still together, and 15 years on, we were sitting on the lounge one night, and I suppose this is part three of the journey, is that, and she wrote a note, and she says, oh, I think I'm an alcoholic. And I said, oh, that's all right, I can fix that. And you see, I felt worthwhile. All of a sudden, I had a task at hand, being task-orientated. So, friends in the town, I was aware of a friend, and he's a he was sober, and we rang him up, and he came round, and he took her off to Christchurch, where they have meetings, or many meetings. In the rural areas, we had one meeting a week. So this 90 meetings in 90 days, they travelled on, and then on off she went. And had a week of that, I think, over a long a public holiday. Came back, and after a period, I don't know, not that long, but she came along and said, "You'll have to go to Al-Anon." And I said, "Well," and I suppose by that time, when again reflection, we talk about our emotions, you know, being cut off when we're little, and trauma happens. So I was still most of my life, I think, I acted like my reactions were that of a child or a young person. So it was a little person and a big person's body. And when it came to behaviours, it seemed to be that those behaviours came out more often, as the sulks and the moans and the not speakies and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, just being a typical me, I can't say a typical bloke, I rushed off to meet a lady who was in Al-Anon from around the road. And in the belief, of course, my good responses to her demands would lead to some form of intimacy, but no, that didn't happen either. So, but anyway, I met my good friend Gwen, and her husband was the local AA. I've got to say that I know we're all sort of equal today, but he was the Grand Poobah of AA. His house was a meeting house. People would just, he was unwell, he couldn't work through health issues, so it was always a constant stream of people going there to get better. And in that time, I meeting Gwen and sharing, or was talking to her because she was trying to encourage me to Al-Anon. And I'm not quite sure that it was for me, but anyway, in that desire to please, I went to the local meeting here in Alexandra all those years ago, many one days at a time. And I wandered in, and it was a building, an old building, and it was probably winter again, and it was freezing, and it was a building that AA and Al-Anon used. I'm not sure if other people used it. It was sort of in behind a church, and up on the wall I first saw the Serenity Prayer, and I saw the 12 steps of AA. They were up there. They were smoke-stained. People still smoked in meetings. But the feeling, just that, you know, some of you have done it, of course. You walk in and whew, what's this? This is Maya. This is marvellous. This sense of belonging, this sense of family, this sense of just some peace in this room. And so I really loved going to my one meeting a week. But I didn't do anything else. That's the trouble. I went to that meeting and came out and said, "Oh God, that's wonderful." That old sort of, you know, talking it but not walking it. So I continued, and I would go around and interact with Gwen. She was an older lady. In the off days or whatever. They used to talk about doing the steps and stuff like that. And of course, I was still egocentric. And I used to dismiss things if I didn't want to do them. So, and the stuff they tell you now, I'm on it, saying there are any guidelines, why would you bother? You know, it's just like, how can this happen? So I went through that for a long time, really. I pissed about, to be fair, on reflection. Just to get into this program, I didn't grab it with both hands. I really enjoyed the company, the people, but I didn't do any work. And so I, same behaviours, of course, create the same issues all the time. So nothing really changed. I think that in going, of course, that I slowly, something was going in, and whether it was sticking a wee bit. So still in the personal life, or even meeting people, you know, unable to articulate and just be honest and be part of, was still difficult. and that desire, equally the reflection of that to be loved or to be liked, was strong as well. So it's a difficult, it was just an internal war. Anyhow, they ran out of a GR. It's not that we have that many people in service at that time, or nor do people clamour for it. But I thought, oh, that'll suit me. I'll feel important. It was a bit like belonging to committees. So I became the group rep. And in our area, which is the bottom half of the South Island, we used to go to assemblies with AA, with or Al-Anon participation with AA assemblies, try and get there with a large amount of people. And that was this probably a start of more information going in, because we would go to these things and I didn't never understood them because I hadn't started doing any work. Felt like a bit of a fraudster, to be fair, but however, I quite enjoyed all the sharings I'd hear, either from some other Al-Anon people or from the AAs. And a lot of my recovery or starting discovery in the beginning, well, Gwen's husband, Ray, I mean, apart from the fact he was a sober AA, we used to sit on the riverbank and fish and talk about men's things that I didn't talk about with anyone. So that was a great help right through then. And obviously today I understand, by the grace of God, I could have flipped either side of the fence, but I am where I am. And so that GR led to district rep at that time. New Zealand had 9 districts. And so shortly after, again, for a lack of volunteers, I went, oh, yes, I'd like to be the district rep. I want to get into service. I'm feeling good. I'm meeting lots of people. So I did that. Meantime, still hadn't really started working the steps, didn't have a sponsor, enjoyed my meetings, talked up Al-Anon, but still behaved the same way. Smiley face out front, still internally sort of challenged. That continued, went to the first conference up in Auckland, flew up there, and there was all these people, and I thought it was a sharing caring fellowship, and then I realized that we all just carry our disease in our pockets, and everyone knows something about something. And so I felt there was a bit of tension, and all my life when there was tension or there was feeling uncomfortable, I'd always create behaviors or something to either divert attention from whatever was happening over the other side of the room, or just shut down, really. And certainly there was some tension there about across the conference room. That was my experience, and I felt uncomfortable, but equally at the same time I was learning a lot. I suppose it's about 4 or 5 years, and I really realised I had to do some serious work on myself. And so locally I knew people in mental health. We had Hamner Springs in. It was a recovery centre in the Canterbury region, and they basically worked the 12-step program, and I went along to the local lady who I knew, and I said, can you get me in there? Because I realised I had to do something more than I had been doing. And so she managed to get me in on the government-sponsored rather than private, and off we went. So in that time, I went to conference. I met my sponsor, who became my sponsor. She was, again, an older lady. I don't know why I pick on older ladies, but she was there. And she's a black and white Al-Anon. But she had so much serenity, it surrounded her like a halo. And that attracted me, and I certainly wanted that. So we got on, and she lived in Auckland, and I was, of course, down south, and we had many hours on the telephone. And we were coming up to the next, it might have been the second conference I went to, and it was a sequence of events. I'd been trying to start the journey. You know, I'm meant to be talking about step one, but to get to step one was a bit of a journey. I went to conference, I'm pretty sure. I went back to Christchurch, bussed up to Hamner, and started this journey in the recovery centre. And I was a bit miffed there too. I got there and they gave me a medical and pushed on my liver to see whether I'd been drinking too much and all that sort of stuff, and I ended up sleeping with They put you in a shared room for a start because some people that were arriving were obviously trying to improve their chances in the justice system, and so they were just still coming off the drugs and alcohol or whatever their choice was at the time. And I don't know that I had a lot of compassion in those days, to be fair. So I got a bit miffed and resentful about that. But anyway, the program started. We were there for 5 weeks. There was class sessions and there was outside sessions. And with me, I took my little picture of me when I was about 2 or 3 years old, this little boy. And every night I'd get in my room and I'd say, "Now, come on, Arnold. Somehow we've got to fix this." And I knew that much. And having heard a bit about Al-Anon, because they talked the 12 steps, obviously, every day I just prayed for something to happen. And not everyone, but some, we get some groups are picked. It's just whatever. We can say coincidence or God incidence now. I got into this group that was going to do psychodrama, and I was looking forward to that, and I felt that maybe that's something would happen. I wasn't quite sure. We had two distinct groups within the recovery facility. We had Taha Māori, which was set up for the native New Zealanders as such, and then the others. But we'd meet together for these things. So anyway, that's this. Got to the psychodrama, and it was set for 9 o'clock in the morning on the Monday. And we all arrived, and the other group arrived a bit later, and were laughing and giggling, and it didn't mean much. And I suppose I was really on edge. I thought I didn't know what to expect, to be fair. But that first session was, he set up the room like taking a human photograph. And he'd say, "Go out there and do what you're going to do, and put yourself with your family, and stand, you know, grab a few other people, and go out with the people that you've got, and create a family, the family that you know." And so I did that, and that was quite powerful, really, because I grabbed some people in my group, and we all had turns, but I found that I was standing off to the side of this group, and that's where I felt I belonged, outside of it, rather than a part of. So I went away with the shift. I mean, these visual things were better for me. Next day we went in, and because you only got 3 sessions, same thing. We started a bit of toing and froing and finally got down to it, and the psychodramist or the psychotherapist, he picked another fella, and we sat around the wall, and of course he did his magic and created the story and created the scene, and others in the room were used as different props, as mothers or fathers, brothers and sisters. And I got to sit through that one, and I just didn't realise at the time. I really felt like it was done in a subdued, well, they let the lighting down because it was more about him arriving home at night time. And I sat there, and of course, we've made friends with other people. And look, I didn't realise it. I just cried the whole time. I cried and I cried, and I came out, and I was soaked, and it felt like someone was kicking me in the guts the whole time, like punching me. And I knew that I had to do this. I was obviously too scared to go up directly and say, "Hey, pick me tomorrow." So whatever happened, coincidence, God, we started again the next day and got our hour and a half session. And again, the other group came in, and they're shambling in like a bunch of sheep and didn't have much care in the world. And so he threw us all out and said, "Come back and set your brains." But he picked me, and I go, "That's God, some magic happened that day for me." That's where I relived my youth, going back to childhood, my mother leaving, and that sense of loss or abandonment or attachment, words like that. All things that I think that, you know, close my ability to be part of the world. And so this session continued, and it's 1 minute I'd be me, and then I had to be mum talking to me, and then I had to be me talking back to mum. And equally, I grabbed other people that were either my friends or mothers or fathers. You just became whoever you want them to be. He led the whole drama through. And So I got to tell Mum off, really, that's the upshot of it. And he really pestered me. He said, no, tell her off. Tell her how you really feel. And I was swearing. I was cursing, swearing and screaming. Anyway, I did this, and then there was this other guy who was, could have been my brother. I don't know what he was in the psychodrama. I turned on him. Name was my father, and I turned on and had a crack at him too. And it was like all this pent-up 35, 40 years of whatever age I was there, of frustration and inability to articulate those things. And then I finished. It finished. He said, right, we'll have a wind down. Don't talk to him. And I would, if I went in, you know, like at 18 stone, I felt like I came out at 9 stone or 100 kilos, 50 kilos, depending what language we work in. It was magnificent on the other side of it. So it took that long to clear that debris or for me to become willing. At the same time in my work, I was working in schools with children as the police officer in schools, and we were delivering a whole lot of programs from how to ride a bike, cross, get on a bus, all that stuff, to keeping ourselves safe, which is a program that was developed in New Zealand in the 80s for basically abuse. It was a program about where kids were learned to keep safe, and it was about feelings, and if you're not feeling good about this and that, so you can talk about it, because obviously abuse occurs in families, most of it's hidden, 95%. And actually in delivering that program, because we had to go to schools and I had to present it on behalf of us and the schools, and then some teachers wouldn't take it, and so I ended up doing it a lot. And I think through that process, that historical abuse started to lessen, that the shame, the feelings of it. In a way that meant it, so through work. It lessened, so it wasn't such a stain. It was that, like we hear sometimes in the rooms, you can look back, leave the door ajar, and have a wee look, but don't, let's not dwell there too often now, whereas in the past I dwelled for a long time. And so I think in line with the psychodrama, the work I was doing in schools, and there was some other work. We had DEAR, which is an American-based from way back then, Drug Abuse Resistance Education, and it came to New Zealand and it was picked up for a lot of our Form 1, Year 6, 7 students. What is that? It's 11, 12-year-olds. And there was another, we did DEAR to make change, and we read, it was a reading therapy thing that was used for a short time until there were some contractual issues, but someone else was worrying about that. But it was a book, The Gem of the First Water. It was a story about a boy who was on a journey, and it was about change. And in theory, you read the story to kids, you know, groups of kids that were struggling at school and that sort of thing. And they obviously, the theory was they would attach themselves to somebody in the journey and see that change was possible. And that was underpinned by a guy, Glasser. He's an American psychiatrist. Glasser's theory, which was called, originally it was called, I think it was control theory, which really suits me as an Al-Anoner, because that's what I like, control. Everything had to be fixed and I could, you know, knock myself. But he changed his end to choice theory. So he came out originally and then he renamed it choice theory, and then it's probably in that time working with the sponsor, all these things happening, the psychodrama, that time in the rehab, for want of a bit of a word, great changes were occurring in me. And I was sitting down and I was actually doing some work in regard to the 12 steps that had been introduced to me some years prior. So I was working through that process, and then really that was one day we had to go to a training session and where they were trying to explain this choice theory business to us. And for me, that was my aha moment. We were talking about this, because until then, it's like the description was a car, and if you're traveling along and one of the wheels is flat, it's always imbalanced, you know, it's not in balance, and there's a bit of a wobble on, and I think that's how I lived in life. There was always a bit of a wobble on, and I had one of these things that, of course, if something happened in front of me, just like I said earlier, the tension, or I would react to it or create another behaviour to divert attention or prevent what was meant to happen happening, because everything's centred on me, of course. And that's, as silly as it sounds in hindsight, that's where I learned that there's the peace between the information that gets in here and the reaction over there, that you can stop in the middle and think, oh, has that got anything to do with me? Do I have to say anything? Was it about me? And it's like that was just on that day. All those things came together, and then I had the sense of, I started to understand this term powerlessness, because until then, I'm 6'3", and I played rugby, and I refereed rugby, and I could stand my own in that physical sense with others, but it was, of course, the internal thing about being humble. Same time this is all happening, I'm creeping into the shower and getting down on my knees, and I'm saying, God, let me be humble. Will somebody break this denial or whatever it is? I'd get down on my knees, and then three little blonde girls coming in, as they do, they watch your father having the shower. Wherever you are in the house, your kids find you. And so all of a sudden I'd have a little blonde head come around, like, what are you doing, Dad? Oh, just cleaning the plug hole, Dad, just like this. But it was all those actions that made me realise that I had to stick out of my backside and become humble to something greater than me. And I always think step one, two, and three is sort of they all get tied into together. Same time, of course, I was my sponsor. She suggested I write down my life story. So it was all happening. I was writing a bit of a documentary, I suppose, at the time. And I think the good thing. And again, in hindsight, with that, is every time you write something, when you go back to it, you read it again. And of course, I've heard about all those things, journaling. So it's probably there where I got step one and realised that I was powerless. And it was nothing to do with physical. It was just I was powerless to basically anything external to me. Of course, it says powerless over alcohol, but I've learned over the years we can add anything to that. So people, places, and things. And that great shift. And even my supervisor at work, he said, something's changed in you, Arnold. You've become more mellow, more chilled, more relaxed, and rather than just the way I obviously interacted previously. And life at home didn't get much better, really. I think we'd burnt all the bridges. My sponsor really hoped that I would find my way through the 12 steps and the miracles would happen. But in the end, Al-Anon gave me the courage to actually ask for a divorce. And it's something, another thing that was ingrained in me, maybe because of my parents' divorce. I never wanted to do it. And so I did that. And of course, going back to our Dutch heritage, is that we don't like spending money. And of course, every year that I stayed in the marriage, it cost me more to get out, you know. So it's... But anyway, it happened, and life moved on. Unfortunately, my children were adolescents sort of through that time. They've had to head their own journey, and I it moved on from that relationship and entered another one. Who would you pick? Yes, but after that, accelerated my recovery. I was in service. I got on the. I was on the. I see them coming up. I got on to further service. I got on the board of New Zealand. At the bottom of the V, I was serving all those people above us, of course. And, of course, in doing service, I really learned that when my head was busy doing serving others, I didn't have a lot of time for my own inadequacies or poor me's or obsessions. And I, look, life... All those million one days at a time, I got into service. I held several roles. I became the board chair, got the international delegate. I always said the first time in 2010 we went to Virginia Beach when they had the IAGSN meeting there. And I was reflecting then that when I started, they let me turn on the heaters in the rooms. And then, 10, 15 years later, I'm representing New Zealand at an international event within this fellowship, which just shows it's possible that the shift, the miracle can happen. And then I went on to South Africa, when they hosted the IGCM there in 2012 with my good friend Paula, who was coming on after me. I went to the International in 2013 in Vancouver. I shared that on the International the night they opened, and that was a big event, same story, just a few years ago. And then, of course, still being on the on our local board, I, as the General Secretary eventually, I ended up going to the World Service Conference and meeting the lovely Yvonne and many others. And she was trying to break the rules there too, take a video of me to take back to California. And so my service ended, I suppose, 2018, I think. I've been 2 years out of that sort of level of service, and I still are attached to our National Literature Committee, I think, and life has been good. So the miracle happened. I've been more serene. I've experienced miracles within the Al-Anon Fellowship, and it's still goes on today, isn't it? Because even though I was nervous about talking, I know that I'll feel quite good when I'm finished. So it's just one of those things. And I think that's me, really.
Great, Arnold. Thank you so much. Yeah, you got